Those were the voices of young people in their teens and 20s from Knoll, Missouri, and Garden City, Kansas. Their families are from Vietnam, Somalia, Burma, Thailand, and Mexico. And they were interviewed for Harvest Public Media's series In the Shadow of the Slaughterhouses, reported by Peggy Lowe and Abby Fentress Swanson. Abby is joining us from station KBIA in Columbia to tell us a little more about the issues they explored in the series. Abby, welcome to Casey Kearns.
Thanks, Sylvia.
So, Abby, why did you want to tell the stories of these young people?
Well, we actually got Peggy and I...
I think we lost Abby for a minute now just because of our phone connection, but I also want to welcome our other guest here from over the phone from Garden City is Deborah Bolton, a family life educator at Kansas State University Research and Extension. Thanks for joining us on Casey Currents.
Thank you, Maria. Or Sylvia.
Sylvia Maria, is it? Thank you.
Sylvia Maria.
tell me, did you hear the stories of those young people that we just aired?
Yeah.
Did that resonate?
It's consistent with the families that I work with. I'm a social researcher, and I've been doing multilingual research here in Finney County, Garden City. And what I do know is that the families that come here to work very hard, and they want the best things for their children. And, you know, it's what we call the American dream. We want to do well in life. We want to live in middle class, and we want our children to do well. And the families that I work with are just, they have those same dreams. And when you talk about some of the barriers, we do see some barriers for students. One, I heard the one young man say something about the family saying, go work in the beef packing plant. Well, I've worked with high school counselors that tell the boys, go work in a beef packing plant. You can make $13 an hour, which sounds like a lot of money. If you consider someone working at mid-management coming from Mexico, for example, is making 190 pesos a day, that's about equivalent to $19 a day. So $13 an hour sounds like a lot until you start having a family and start having those obligations, which they find out in some cases a little late.
And how long have you been doing this kind of work in Garden City?
I would say for 20 years. I worked in Head Start for a long time. Then I went to adult education for 11 years, and I was always working with the families. And now as an extension specialist and social researcher, I'm still working with families. This past summer, this has gotten some national attention. We started three bilingual, bicultural 4-H programs, and we were expecting maybe 30 people in a program, and we had 90 families, and we did 4-H with whole families, not just 7 years old and above.
That's interesting. Is that the first time that 4-H has been, there has been a bilingual and bicultural program?
I think so. I think so. And bilingual and bicultural was a really important thing to do because identification and self-identification is important in how the students view themselves. Yes, you're in a U.S. American society, but it's okay to feel proud of who you are and where you came from. And so that's where we call it bicultural, because they're in two cultures.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Are you from Garden City originally?
No, I grew up in the mountains of Colorado.
And do you have a sense of, I mean, how long has the immigrant community been an influence in Garden City? I mean, a long time, right?
Oh, a long time. Most recently, the 1980s is when the beef packing plants came, and that's when a pretty large influx of Hispanics and Southeast Asians came. But way before that, in the early 20th century, when the sugar beets and the railroads, at that agriculture, and then of course the railroad brought a mixture of multicultural populations, Hispanic, Germans, and they worked side by side. So Finney County has had a long, they've been integrating those communities a long time. So that's why Finney County is such a favorite place for researchers to come, because they keep asking the question, why does it work so well in Finney County when other counties that have a lot of the same demographics doesn't seem to work as well? But
and how do you answer that question?
I say it's the history. Look at history here. We know that immigrants are an asset for the kind of work that's done in Southwest Kansas, largely rural, largely agricultural. And I was talking to one of the Royal Farm Dairies, is the name of one of the dairies in town, and he says, you know, Southwest Kansas is an economic empire with beef processing and other agricultural, but the good thing is that we could not have done this without immigrant populations coming in, and they have the aptitude for the work. It's hard work. It's not work that we raise our children to do a lot necessarily, that I didn't, and I'm not interested in doing that work, and I think I'm like a lot of U.S. Americans thinking that's just not the work I want to do or raise my children to do. So we have a population of people who don't mind doing the work.
And from what I understand, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the Garden City has a similar history, let's say, to nearby Dodge City and Liberal, Kansas, that also have for quite a long time seen immigrants and the Latino population, really, that is almost, you know, really part of the history of that community. But those communities maybe have not been as successful in this integration and in helping these young people, you know, develop their futures.
Well, and I don't have the answer to why they are not. I've worked in those other communities, and I see that. I think that in some ways they're a more invisible community. The subcommunities are a little more invisible. That's only been my observation. I don't have any data to back that up, but I do have data to back up how we work with the populations in Finney County. And when you talk about supporting young students, we still do have a large dropout population because they don't feel successful in the schools. But and I know our schools work very hard on that. And I think part of it is qualitatively, most of my work is quantitative, but I do go out and do interviews and to find some qualitative backup. For example, why are our students, our Latino students, leaving school before graduation? And I find that a lot of times the families are poor. They need someone to work. The parents didn't graduate themselves, so they only know this kind of work, so they think, well, maybe we don't need that. But as the parents start learning the importance and the difference between not having a high school degree or diploma and just getting one, what that does to raise the economic value of, you know, human capital, it's quite amazing. And that's something my research has really shown, the difference between not having a high school degree and at least getting a high school.
And I want to bring in now our reporter from Harvest Public Media, Abby Fentress Swanson. She's at KBIA in Columbia, Missouri. Abby, welcome to KC Currents.
Thanks, Sylvia.
And tell me, why did you want to tell the stories of these young people, you and Peggy Lowe, who did this series for Harvest?
Yeah, our reporting project actually started with a very generous grant that we got from the Institute for Justice and Journalism, and they sort of wanted us to focus on immigrant children, and we thought, how can we focus on immigrant children while still covering what we do best at Harvest, which is agriculture and food production issues? So we decided to look at the children of slaughterhouse workers because most of them are immigrant and refugee workers. And, you know, we'd seen a lot of stories about the adult workers, but we hadn't seen a lot of stories about children. And that kind of got us thinking about this sort of really invisible population of kids who are living in often small rural towns across the country, and they don't often have access to a lot of social services that such a new diverse population needs.
And that's different from the children of immigrants and refugees in cities?
Yeah, I mean, I think back in the day, immigrants mostly did settle in larger cities like Chicago and Kansas City, and that's where the meatpacking plants were too. But there's been a gradual trend, what experts call new immigration, which is immigrants settling outside of bigger cities, and that's where the meatpacking plants are too. And I did most of my reporting in a very small town in rural Missouri in southwest Missouri called Knoll. It's a town of about 1,800 people. And it's such a small, remote place that the nearest food pantry and free clinic are really miles away. And so you have this very diverse population of Mexican immigrants, Somalis, Burmese, Sudanese, workers and their families. And they just it's really hard for them to kind of get everything that they need because they're in this very small, remote place.
And when did that influx start in Knoll?
That started in the mid-90s. Hispanics moved first, some of them undocumented. There have been raids in Knoll before. And then Pacific Islanders, who I didn't mention before, they came next, followed by Somalis in the late 2000s. And now Burmese and Sudanese refugees are beginning to move to Knoll to take these jobs.
And what did you find is the climate towards welcoming new arrivals, immigrants and refugees, and particularly their children, as compared to what we're hearing about Garden City?
Yeah, I think Garden City, I mean, it's a much larger town. I think it's about 30,000 people, something like that. But I think Knoll has, when Mexicans first arrived in the mid-90s, I think it was probably way more difficult than it is now for immigrants. But the town has really struggled to try to embrace these newcomers. The Somalis I talked to, some of them, and said they'd really had a hard time fitting in and feeling welcome there. I talked to several people who'd had their tires slashed recently. And also there's a diner on Main Street, which is called Kathy's Country Kitchen with all K's. And I had been told by Somalis that they didn't feel welcome there. Their T-shirts sold inside that diner that say, "I got caught eating at the KKK." Huh. So things like that, particularly for the Somali population, I heard from them that, you know, had made it a little more difficult. That said, I think the schools are really trying hard to make this, all of the kids who are coming into town, feel welcome, certainly, and also address needs that they have. I mean, there are a dozen languages spoken there, and they work really hard on ELL learning. They send backpacks, like 40 backpacks full of food home with lots of kids every week. And they talk about immigration. It's kind of part of the school day now. So.
You're listening to Casey Currents on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Later this hour, we're going to hear how a post office in Overland Park is honoring veterans. But now we're talking about the challenges and opportunities facing the children of immigrants who work in meatpacking plants in rural parts of Kansas and Missouri. We're joined by Harvest Public Media reporter Abby Fentress Swanson and Deborah Bolton, a family life educator and researcher with Kansas State University's Research and Extension Program. Do you live in a rural community with a slaughterhouse? How have immigrants affected life there? Join our conversation at 816-235-2888, or you can comment on KCUR's Facebook page. Deborah Bolton, you mentioned this idea of immigrants being invisible in some other communities, and maybe they're more visible in Garden City. What does that look like?
I would say it's integrated, more integrated, and that's when we say invisible. You know, you're not seeing other communities celebrating, for example, Fiesta together. And my observation has been, if you were looking at social capital, for example, what are the things where everybody is involved? The schools are a great equalizer, where it doesn't matter for school programs and school sports. Non-Anglos and Anglos participate at about the same rate. And in churches, non-Anglos and Anglos participate in about the same rate. So we see that those social institutions are great equalizers. And when you see that kind of count, you see that a community is integrated. For parades, for example, we have the Beef Empire Days Parade. Everybody comes out for that. It doesn't matter what the ethnicity doesn't. The ethnic people and non-ethnic people, or Anglo and non-Anglo, participate at about the same rate. So we see that as great integration.
And Abby, now, I just wonder. Oh, go ahead, Deborah.
Well, your focus has been more on the children, I've noticed. And I think the children integrate much easier than the adults since they learn English so quickly. The further you get away from puberty, the harder it is to gain another language, learn a second language, and it's a little harder for the adults. So they don't integrate as quickly as the youth.
And Abby, in doing this reporting along with Peggy Lowe, who was the one who went to Garden City, I wonder, what did you see that Noel is not doing or doesn't have that Garden City is?
Well, my understanding from many conversations with Peggy is that schools are only part of the safety net in Garden City, whereas I felt like in Noel, without those schools, it would have been really, really tough on newcomers coming there because, you know, these schools provide dental cleanings, glasses. They do trauma. They brought in a private provider to do trauma counseling for some of these children. And they do help provide legal assistance when families need it. There's no community center in Noel. There's no free clinic, even though like over 90% of these kids are on free and reduced lunches. There's no emergency room. So, you know, when medical issues come up, these kids bring these things up with their teachers and principals at the schools. And so it's really incumbent upon the schools to try to figure out ways to help all of these kids. I also wanted to agree with what Deborah said. All of the kids I talked to actually did really seem happy in Noel, living in Noel, and they did seem like they were, you know, beginning to integrate pretty well. And when I talked to older residents, they said, yeah, the kids don't have problems. It's really the adults that see color is something I heard from a couple different people.
Huh. Are there some advantages for immigrant and refugee kids being in a rural area rather than an urban area?
That's a good question. I don't know about that. I haven't thought too much about that. Do you have any thoughts, Deborah?
Well, my thought on that is that there may be more opportunities for the children in rural areas to be involved because, for example, the football teams need as many people as they need, or the sports teams, and certainly they've created soccer in rural areas, or not created, but brought with them the love for soccer. And so they just have more opportunities to be involved than they would in an urban setting. I think there are probably more opportunities to be involved in not such good gatherings in an urban setting, where I think there are less opportunities for that in a rural setting.
And until now, we haven't talked about immigration status, but I know, Abby, you've looked into that some. How does that make a difference in terms of kids' futures? Some of the young people you talk to are here legally, and some of them are undocumented.
Yeah, the first cut in the montage was from an 18-year-old high school senior, Oscar, who I interviewed. He's undocumented. His mother brought him to Noel when he was 2 years old to work at the Tyson plant. And when I talked to him, you know, he said he would be the first person in his family to go to college. But the problem with undocumented students, as most of your listeners already know, is that most colleges require social security numbers to apply, and certainly any federal aid that might be available is not is for the most part not available without a social security number. So undocumented kids who are of college age can apply for deferred action for childhood arrival status, which would allow them, if they get it, to stay here for at least 2 years. And then immigration reform advocates are hoping that one day the DREAM Act will pass, which would provide a path for legal citizenship. But it's definitely for kids that I talk to whose parents brought them here to work at the plant who are undocumented, options are very limited, at least for furthering their education.
And yeah. Abby Fentress Swanson, I know that you need to leave us now. She's a reporter for KBIA and Harvest Public Media. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's been a great thing to report on, and I hope that we get to do some follow-up stories down the road.
And Deborah Bolton, I wonder, what do you see in Garden City in terms of the implications of immigration status on young people?
Well, you know, there were some students. I worked with a student who's during the when they had the I forgot the word when they had like a forgiving of, there was this time where you could get your children in under this act.
Right, just recently that the Obama administration, is that right?
No, it was before the Obama, it was during the Clinton administration.
Oh, right, the amnesty then.
Amnesty, I couldn't remember the word. Anyway, and some parents didn't know that they were supposed to enroll their little children in that. And so I worked with a student that went all the way through school, and just about the time she was wanting to apply for college, she realized that her father had not enrolled her in the amnesty. He had enrolled himself, but he didn't know that he was supposed to enroll his infant child. And so she was born in Mexico, but came here in like at 6 months old. So she's still working on that process because she still wants to go to college. And this has been 7 years that she graduated. But there are a lot of disconnects in that system. Like you can have your green card, but it runs out sometimes before you actually get to apply for citizenship. And there are just a lot of little breaks in the system that changes your status from having the proper authorization to not having the proper authorization. So we've worked with some students in that case. But on the other hand, I worked with a student this summer. She's an engineering student at K-State, and she was born in Mexico, came here at a very young age, and but is a DREAM Act student, but still paying. She was able to get her Social Security number and everything. She still doesn't have access to federal aid, but she does get scholarships because she's very bright. Mm. And we have a lot of cases of students who are just very bright, but just the system doesn't always work for them to go beyond high school or sometimes even finish high school.
And we have a call here from Nancy in Eudora. She called 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, yeah. What I'm wondering is, do they believe that they are doing things that Americans will not, people who've been here all their lives and have their citizenship, do they believe they are doing things, working at things that we won't? Because as a child, my mother and I, for a living, we dressed chickens. And we did it without running water and without all the conveniences that they have in the packing plant. So, you know, it's just not true that Americans won't do those jobs. And then my mother went to work in a very contaminated defense plant and stood on her feet through three wars.
Right. Well, thank you, Nancy, for that comment. I want to see if, Deborah, that is something that you mentioned and something that we often hear, that there are immigrants in these communities because there's not enough Americans that will take these jobs.
Well, not enough U.S. Americans. The immigrants that are coming are from the Americas. I just want to clear that part up. But if you come to Southwest Kansas or any deeply agricultural community, they say the same things. I'm hearing this from owners that we do interviews with, and these are owners of large agricultural, like dairies and stuff. They just can't seem to find other people to do the work. And you might say other people to do the work at that wage. And that's been something that's brought up, too. And also, when you were dressing chickens without water, you probably didn't have the regulations that people have today. They're pretty highly regulated, any of the agricultural institutions that are producing food. So you do have to have running water. But, yeah, my own parents were migrant farm workers at one time and worked in not great conditions, but again, I'm not saying that no U.S. American will do that, but we just are not having an easy time finding the people that do that. They don't stay very long.
Deborah, what role do the meatpacking plants, in this case in Garden City, Tyson, and all Missouri, too, what role do they play in taking care of the kids of their workers, particularly immigrant and refugee workers?
I haven't seen that they now I know, like, for example, the packing plant in Finney County really supports United Way and really helps their workers be philanthropists, which they naturally are, but I suppose they feel like they support in an indirect way by supporting something like United Way.
Well, Deborah Bolton, we'll have to end it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Deborah Bolton is a family life educator at Kansas State University Research and Extension. You can read or listen to the Stories in Harvest three-part series In the Shadows of the Slaughterhouses and see photos of the young people interviewed on our website, kcur.org. Coming up after the break, a new website tracks gifts made by lobbyists to Missouri legislators. This is Casey Currents.